and the Leicester meeting that you went to. You told him and he was upset, you said. Pardon? You said he was upset.
Yes, he was upset. He thought Leicester had let him down. Leicester, radical, it was a radical city, really. It had been represented by radicals for years. And he thought that although, say, never approved of the Millicent campaign and the Pankhurst, he thought they ought to have had a fair hearing. It was the crowd, the style, quite different from what he'd expected and what he'd wanted, of course.
Mm.
And he really, it remained with him, that feeling, that even his own people, they were, I suppose in that crowd, was a lot of his own people.
Yes, oh surely, yes.
Because they'd elected him with a big majority. His own people were in that crowd and apparently doing nothing to help these women, allowing the opposition to do all the attacking and giving them, not coming to their help or aid.
Did you, can you remember what Mrs. Pankhurst was like when she spoke? Was she a good speaker?
Oh, she was a very good speaker. Very attractive woman. You've seen the statue, haven't you?
Yes, yes.
Mm. I'll come to that, by the way. She wore, because that was the fashion, a long dress and a bodice, coat and a hat. Very pleasing speaker, fluent.
Mm. You said she kissed you.
She had her moments in replying to interjections. You could score. But when they came so noisy, when they drowned everything, of course, it was ineffective.
Mm.
But she was really ideal for that particular occasion and as a leader of that particular movement.
Mm.
And her daughters were much more aggressive.
Mm.
I think it was Christabel who was there. I forget now who was a more aggressive of the two daughters, but one was more aggressive than the other.
Mm. But you said she kissed you afterwards. Why did she kiss you then?
Pardon?
Why did she kiss you afterwards, do you think?
Well, I was the youngest, you see. I was a boy compared with the grown-up men, and I was actually in front of her. And I was sort of a personal bodyguard. It just happened, that was all. And also, I lost my bowler hat. I mean, that's the only wood it provided me with. I lost my bowler hat.
Was that the only time you saw her, or did you see her on other times as well?
No, I never met her any other time, you see, but the time I got to her, I think she died in 1928.
That's right, yes. Mm. That's right.
Well, so I went to London in 1926, and no other time I came in contact with her personally.
What were the dates, Mr. Campion? When did you start with the Leicester Pioneer then? What was the year? 1910 or so?
1909.
Then you went.
Either 1909 or 1910.
And then you went to Wimslow after about a year.
Then I went to Wimslow.
Yes.
From there.
And then 2 years later, was it, you went to Leeds? When did you go to Leeds from Wimslow? About 2 years after
I went to Wimslow. I went to Leeds from Wimslow in 1912.
I see, yes.
So I married in May 1912. I went almost straight to Leeds.
Mm.
And I left Leeds early 1914. Mm. Mm. So I had about 2 years or a year and a half active work among suffragettes in Leeds.
How do you explain why you're unusual among men in supporting the women, and what is there in your career that makes that possible?
What's my career? I'm sorry.
why were you unusual among men in supporting woman suffrage? What was there about your career or your ideas that made it different?
I don't know. It was sort of instinctive. I can never forget the way my mother was treated and what I saw in workshops, in factories in Leicestershire. I worked in shoe factories, boot and shoe factories, tailoring factories, hosiery factories. Because the woodmill, there were no women in woodmill, the way women were treated. I remember on one occasion working in a tailoring factory, I was worked as a scene presser, press the scenes.
Yes.
And nearby was a row of sewing machines, probably 50. A woman at each one, treadling away. And the proprietor, a little man, a little aggressive man, rough, tough, quite rich, who ran the building, who ran the place, used to come in about 9 o'clock in the morning, which was going to start at 8, and walk up and down that row of machines, urging these women, come on, get on. The poor devils, some were young, some were old, some were middle-aged, but they were all there, frightened of this man, marching up and down, reminiscent of the slave trade, almost. And said the whip, of course, his tongue. And I was not far away doing this pressing, and I could hear this man rile me. I was full of energy and ideas about women, how they should be treated. One morning, I couldn't stand any longer. I'd been doing this for about an hour. I went over to him. I challenged him there. I said, come on, stop this business. Stop it. The way you're treating these women is shocking. So I'm going out into Leicester and expose you. I went now. And I went and put my coat on, walked out, never entered the place again. And when I addressed meetings on the marketplace, I didn't name them, of course, because it's a law of libel, as you know, a law of slander. I often referred to this place without naming it, and I got a certain amount of satisfaction that way. And I also heard of the incident through Ramsay MacDonald, because someone had reached MacDonald's ears about my attitude at that time. It required a lot of courage, but I did it instinctively. I didn't reason, I just acted with instinct or a feeling, emotion. I often did that and rationalised it afterwards.
But you read quite a lot of books as well, didn't you? You read Carlyle and Ruskin, didn't you? I mean, you read books as well.
Yes, and I always wanted to be a writer, an author, and I said about writing books. One day my wife said to me, you've had a marvellous life, why don't you sit down and write about it? It never occurred to me. So I sat down and I wrote my first book in 3 months. About 80 to 90,000 words, Sunlight on the Foothills. I finished it in 1939. And it, just before the summer, and it was, I sent it to an agent, the best agent at the time, named Pinkerton, and it was returned to me just after war had been declared. Been to 12 publishers, had all rejected it because of the war. They were afraid.
Yes.
He himself thought it a very good book, otherwise he wouldn't have sent it out.
Mm.
Then not long afterwards, he wrote to me saying, can I have that manuscript back? Hutchinson have written asking if they can see it again.
Mm.
About second thoughts. They saw it again, they accepted on the spot.
Yeah.
And it was published a year later, and it had, let's say, 100 reviews.
Mm.
Extraordinary thing. One review is something, or two is, but 100. Of course, by this time I was fairly well known.
Yes.
Everybody in Fleet Street knew me.
Yes.
In fact, all newspaper men throughout the country knew me, so that was one reason, really. And
but you said you went. You read Ruskin's Stones of Venice and...
that's when I went to London.
As earlier. When did you start reading these books? What started you reading these books?
Oh, well, now, when I left school at 14, sorry, it's a dreadful thing to say, but I'd never read a book. I was utterly illiterate from that point of view, and yet I was the best school writer in the school, essays and so on. And but I'd never read a book. I had no knowledge of anything. And shortly after I left school, I had an accident. I went to what is called an egg rolling competition at Easter, somewhere in Yorkshire.
Pace eggs. Pace eggs, were they? Yes.
And going down a steep hill from Leicester down to this place, going down a steep hill, I had to turn right or left. There was a wall there. But only to a silly thing I'd done to the bicycle, it refused to operate. I went straight into the wall and over the wall, and I was found some time later and reported in the local paper that I was dead. I'd fractured the base of the skull. Mm. And then I was several weeks in the hospital, about 2 weeks unconscious. When I woke up, I was a different man. Learn. I wanted to learn everything. I came obsessed with the desire to know everything. Began reading books, going to lectures. I remember going to a British Association lecture on the growth of a crystal. I thought, my goodness, how wonderful. Knowledge. I wanted to cram knowledge. I got the idea, an obsession with the cleverest man in the world, that sort of thing. I devoured books, I bought them, I stole them. Well, I only stole one, but the second-hand books.
On the shelves outside the shop, yes.
Mm. Well, I stole one. But otherwise, I could have bought them for about twopence or threepence each. And I built up a little library. I used to go every day, look at my library before I went out, see if they're all there, and count them up, 40, 41, 42. And I became obsessed with this. Now, when the time I was going to London, I really had read quite a lot. But it's not organised knowledge. That's the difference between your knowledge and mine. Yours is organised. And by the time I got going to London, I really knew quite a lot. And I'm really keen on Ruskin, very keen on art. Our natural aptitude for art. I was very good at painting at school, and I used to do sculpture off my own bed. In the streets of Leicester, just outside our house, we're laying sewer pipes, digging up great piles of red clay. I used to take buckets of this red clay, I was still a schoolboy, and make heads and out of them. And I tell you, painting was one of the best painters in the school. And I won a scholarship, really, to this Leicester School of Art. But obviously it's out of the question. Mm. And I just had to paddle along as best I could. But anyhow, when I went to London, set off for London, I took Seven Lamps of Architecture and Carlyle's French Revolution. I remember sitting down under the edge, it was a snowy day, and eating the sandwiches and reading Carlyle's French Revolution, I think it was. But I'm sorry to say this, that by the time I got to Market Harbour, that was about 15 miles away, I was very hungry, I was footsore, I got broken boots, and I spent the shilling, I had a shilling. I'd spent the shilling, I'd eaten sandwiches before I got, that was supposed to be my breakfast at the woodmill. I was supposed to have gone to the woodmill. I started at 6 o'clock in the morning. I'd eaten sandwiches, it was supposed to be my breakfast, and sandwiches for lunch. And I was very hungry. I spent the shilling on a meal in Market Harbour, soup and so on, getting warm. I had nothing but the two books. And I thought, well, I must get some money. So I took them to a pawn shop. And the pawnbroker laughed. I said, we can't accept those. And we'll take those sort of things. I said, what do you want? I said, oh, I want to buy some food. I said, I want to sell the books for that. He said, well, I'll buy them. So I'll give you a shilling each for them. So I gave him 2 shillings, and that had to last me until I got to Northampton.
You were walking to London, were you?
Pardon?
You were walking to London.
Yeah, how are you? Mm.
How old were you then, Mr. Campion?
About 18, 17.
Yeah.
Well, at the wood mill, so I left the wood. The point is, you see, I hadn't said a word to anybody. I'm afraid I used to work in secret. I was afraid of telling everyone, they'd put me off. I went to the wood mill at 6:31 morning, at 6 o'clock, at 5:31 went to bed at 6, presumably going to the wood mill, with my carpet bag, with my food in, and instead of going straight on to the wood mill, I turned left, which took me on the road to London. It was snowing, in January, about January 1908. It was snowing, and I went on and on through the rich parts of Leicester and on, say, eventually reaching Market Harbour. On the way, I met a tramp, and he stopped me. He said, "Surely not one of us." I said, "Why?" He said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to London." He said, "What for?" I said, "I want to be a journalist, a writer." Oh, it was a useless idea. He was walked with a lame foot, club foot. He said, "Oh," he said, "cut out an idea," he said, "come with me." I said, "Where?" He said, "Well, I'm going to Derby." I said, "I'm only get to Derby sometime." I said, "I have a good break there." So I got the keys, he showed me a bunch of what were skeleton keys. He said, "We can manage it together, see, you can get through the window and I have all the keys and I'll keep watch." Oh, I was scared to death. I ran away. He called me back. No, he couldn't, he was clubfoot, he couldn't get very far. I ran on and on and lost sight of him. Then I got to Northampton. At Northampton, by the time I got there, I was worn out. I went in my innocence. I went to the Labour Club, or the Labour Office. I told them what had happened, and the agent said, "Oh, how sorry he was for me." He himself had just sent out for a jug of hock tea and a pile of buttered toast. And he sat there by that warm fire, the pile of toast, that high, a jug of tea. I was absolutely famished, looking at him, never offered me a bite or a drink. After that, I left him, and I went out and thought, "Well, let's do something." So I began singing in the street, and snowing, and a man passed, and he turned back. He said, "What are you doing this for?" I said, "Well, I'm trying to get to London." "What's your name?" I told him. "Where are you from?" "Leicester." And he said, "I don't, but MacDonald's name came up," and I said, "I knew Ramsay MacDonald, not very well, but I knew him." I said, "Oh, I know Ramsay MacDonald. Anyhow, what do you want? That's what you got to find a bed tonight." I said, "Yes." "Well," he said, "come along with me." He took me to the YMCA. I had some conference with somebody, and then he gave me some money and took me to an hotel where I could spend the night and bit refreshed for the morrow. Then when I got up in the morning at this hotel, and I remember I couldn't eat my breakfast, I was trembling with cold, so I drank all the hot water in the jug. Then I started on my breakfast to warm myself up. And I thought, "Well, it's a daft idea walking to London when I might get a train. After all, train fare, when I come to think about it, a train fare would have been 10 shillings.
Yeah. Mm.
So I knew I had some relatives in Northampton. What my parents were thinking about, I don't know. See, I didn't turn up. They were wondering what had happened to me. And then I thought, "Well, I have some relatives." I knew their name, but I had no idea where they lived. So I went to the local library and got hold of the electoral roll, went down all the streets until I found the name and the address, of course. Well, I went, and I was startled to see me.
especially in the condition I was. I said, what's the matter? What are you doing? I told him I was going to London. What for? Well, I want to become a journalist and perhaps Prime Minister. Perhaps Prime Minister. Prime Minister? You Prime Minister? You Prime Minister? Your brains, you've got Prime Minister. Come off it. You've got about a scruff of my neck, my uncle, whatever he was. Marched me off to the station. Put me in a third class compartment, or what it was, a compartment. And it was very cold, and had these feet warmers, not really, just my feet warmers. And opposite me sat a lovely girl in fur coat. Well, I'm most embarrassed with all my rags and sawdust clothing from the woodmill. This girl kept looking at me and wondering things and seeing me being hustled in. And I got home. My mother just had a telegram saying I was been put on the train. They had reported me to the police as missing. And poor mother's upset. Anyhow, she said, she really admired me for it. Said, you'll get somewhere, you know, eventually. My father's very annoyed. Said, I'll get nowhere. Changing and chopping about. See, I'd been all these various jobs in Leicester. I get nowhere. Keep to one thing. However, that was that. Mm. And then, as I say, Ramsay MacDonald, the post on the Pioneer, now Sir Edward Wood. Here I go back again. When I was selling newspapers outside the Midland Station, Sir Edward Wood comes onto the scene. I'd lost my voice. In those days, I don't think there were any posters. You had to shout the news. So I used to shout the news, I had a powerful voice. And one day I got to the station, straight from school. I found my voice had gone. What was I to do? I solved that problem just below the station. Mark and Spence had opened their new penny bazaar, just a penny bazaar. I went there and I bought a box of coloured chalks, one penny. I went back to the station, got the stone flags. I wrote the main news items. On a crowd gathered round, and a man came forward in the crowd and said, well, I consider that real enterprise, real enterprise. What's your name? I said, Sidney Campion. Right, I remember that. And he pressed a coin into my hand and went away. I don't know who he was. And the crowd said, do you know who he is? And I said, no. He said, it's Edward Wood, chairman of Freeman, Hardy and Willis. That was that. So when I went to interview him, this when I wrote to him.
You wanted clothes. You wanted to get some clothes to equip yourself as a journalist, yes.
When I went to interview him, he had a pile of letters there. In the most elaborate office, even an oak chair there, and I was sitting on the side of the table, oak desk, and pile of letters, and see all these letters? They're begging letters. I get them every day. So I've got yours, but yours is different, and I remember you. I wrote, see, on a foolscap sheet in big letters in green ink, and a steel pen, and I think it rather amused him. Anyhow, It was remembering the writing on the pavement that sort of helped him to decide to help me in this predicament.
Mm. Did you start speaking in public first in the women's movement? Was that the first time you spoke in public?
Oh, yes.
Or did you speak before
yes,
then?
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm.
Yes.
Well, yes, I suppose what I did it deliberately. I used to go around to debating societies, giving a paper. Mm-hmm. I mean, I determined to be a speaker. So I went around debating societies, giving papers on this, that, and the other. And then eventually I became so keen, and another young chap, well, a bit older than I, we joined forces, but I didn't shoot, and he made the bullet, so to speak. I must have been very young, because I left school at 14. One night, I took a chair from our kitchen and placed it under a lamp, and the centre was six or seven rows, all converged. An ideal place for a meeting.
In Leicester, this is. In Leicester.
In Leicester.
Yes.
I was only about 16. And it was evening, of course, and I got on this chair and started speaking. Nobody, of course, speaking to an empty space, so to speak. Gradually, people gathered round, and eventually got an enormous crowd. I mean, I being so young and telling how to put the world right and so on. And in the course of the meeting, there was a disturbance. So I said, "What is the matter over there, please?" So someone said, "Is your schoolmaster here?" He said, "We were teaching you a school lesson 2 years ago. How can you know all about the world as you reckon you do?" Well, the crowd took my side. They thought I was being very courageous. Anyhow, they said about his teacher for being so ungallant, not giving me any credit. And I've been mooching about like the rest of the youngsters, all well and good, but here, challenging something.
Was that a socialist speech you were giving? Was it a speech for the Labour Party that you gave?
No, it was purely on my own. Mm. It was preaching Labour politics, but it's purely on my own. I done it because I felt like it. And this young chap who had been connected with the Salvation Army was sort of spurred me on and prompted me and stimulated me. And I say, he made the bullets and I fired them. He just was there for moral support.
So you got quite a lot of speaking experience before you joined the women's movement. Yes. What about your parents, Mr. Campion? I mean, did they encourage you in your reading and your study then? Did your parents encourage you to read and to study?
No. We had no books. All I read was the papers that came to the house. Trivial things like a paper called Answers. You want to know of that?
Yeah, I know.
Bits and sort of thing. Of course, the newspaper, I devoured every line in the newspaper. I read the newspaper every night from front to back. I knew every word in the newspapers. So I got a good general knowledge in that way, but I had no academic knowledge.
But how do you explain what happened when you had your accident with the bicycle? How do you explain that you suddenly got this desire to learn?
How did what?
What's the reason for your sudden change after you had the accident with your head?
I don't know that there's some physiological reason for the change or some awakening of the adolescence. Slow adolescence, I don't know.
Mm.
But
there was nobody who was influencing you then? No person influencing you?
No. It just happened. I remember waking up and feeling quite different. And I became friendly with a young chap who was, well, it was sort of the fourth problem of the fourth dimension, but he was very keen on this business, and he was a secularist, and he was very keen on science. He was an engineer, in a higher grade engineering, and he was just a little older than I was, and he was a great help. And they put books in my way, and scientific books like Haeckel's Riddle of the Universe and so on and so forth. And I started going to lectures, and I said the British Association lecture on the growth of the crystal, which set me absolutely on fire. I went to a classical concert. The first classical concert I went to, about this time, was I heard the Hebrides, Mendelssohn, about 100 performers. Oh, it was moving. Oh, terrible.
Mm.
And I had all these experiences late in life as a trouble. So I never read a fairy story until I was 30. I never read my first fairy story at 30. Mm. Books like Jane Eyre and so on. I had no child reading.
So your parents weren't really a very important influence on you?
Oh, no, no. Well, my mother was, my father wasn't. My father became a Chelsea pensioner, but he joined up in the Grenadier Guards, I think it was. Oh, no, the Coldstream Guards, as a youth. Became an active soldier and fought in the Sudan, had two war medals. Then he came out of the army, and my mother came from Wisbech, he came from Northamptonshire. And my mother was at one period, just for a short period, an artist model. And she didn't like that because she said that what they expected was not only the pose, but to go to bed with them. And she couldn't do that. So then my father was a drunkard and a gambler. He earned £1 a week and was very highly intelligent, but not educated, because there was no education very much in those days. But my mother was much more intelligent, much more far-seeing. She had vision, she had ambition, very ambitious. And she could understand my wanting to get out of the slums into something better. She encouraged it. And when I set off for London, as I say, she thought it was a grand gesture. And
was she badly treated by your father, do you think? Was your mother badly treated by your father? Was she well-treated or badly treated by your father?
Well, no, I wouldn't say well-treated, sort of on and off. When they married, he did reform. She only married on condition he gave up drink. He gave up. And for a period, he was in the Salvation Army. And then used to beat the big drum and so on. And then by one of these wicked coincidences, he worked at the wood mill. Where I worked, he worked at the wood mill. And by one of these wicked coincidences, one morning he went to the mill and found there a new man had been taken on from his own regiment, wartime pals. So that started him off drinking again. Now, I say, I worked in the wood mill where he worked. He was a labourer. I was supposed to be becoming a craftsman. And a highly skilled. And in the wood mill, this shows you emotional impacts and so on. In the wood mill was a young chap who was a local preacher for the Methodists. He used to talk to me about this and that and the other. And eventually got me interested in Orthodox religion. And eventually, we together conducted services in the wood mill. Mm. The wood mill, I said, there'd be about 100 employed there. And on the first floor, very spacious with all the machines, etc., and a large open door to get the wood in and out. And occasionally, in the lunch hour, we used to hold a service there, and all the men would come, sit on the sawdust, on the bags of sawdust and the wood, and would conduct a service. And we took it in turn, preaching the sermon. So we'd have a little hymn, a short prayer. The sermon was a great thing, and it became a competition. Who could preach the best sermon? I'm sure it was nothing more than that. And he preached one day, I preached the next day. And my aim was to preach better than he could preach. And it got to the stage where, again, off my own battle, of my own volition, in another part of Leicester, I used to preach the gospel for a short period, very short period, but still very intense, very earnest, while sort of just had got me. And after that, I became, as I say, interested in science and sociology and so on, and I became an agnostic or humanist they call nowadays, and such that I've remained. I'm interested in psycho research and so on.
I wondered, you see, whether you supported the women's movement because your mother had been kept under.
Great influence, no doubt about that. Oh, yes. See, as I say, my mother went out to work, earning a shilling a day, all day long, for one shilling. I thought it was marvellous. And I know one day I came home and she'd been crying. It was my birthday. School. I ran home because we had no bread and jam for the birthday tea instead of this bread and margarine. And I got home, I could see she'd been crying over the bread and jam. And at some point, I said, why have you been crying? She showed me a purse, it was empty. I said, you see, the purse is empty, I don't know what I'm going to do for the rest of the week. Well, that movement, more than anything, I went straight, I said, I'm going to sell newspapers. I went straight out, I went to a neighbour, I explained what I wanted, I said, can you lend me fourpence? I want to go selling paper. I got fourpence, I went down to the Leicester Mercury office, I bought a dozen papers, which for fourpence, which I sold a halfpenny each, so a dozen produced tuppence. I went on and on selling and going and getting some more. I earned over a shilling that night. Took it home. Gave it to my mother. The father was outraged. Oh, didn't go for me. Letting the family down. What would people say? You standing outside there, people who know me. You standing outside the railway station there. Selling newspapers. Did you meet with the lowest of the low? I said, yes, I did. And I also said later on, I met the highest of the high. That was MacDonald and Cedric Wood, plus others.
But your father had drunk all your mother's money, had he?
A lot of it, oh, yes.
I see, yes.
I'd say you got £1 a week. I'd say by the time he came home Saturday night, if she got 10 shillings, she'd be lucky. But then, as I say, she went out to work, I was selling newspapers, so we had to make it up that way. Just one other point, and it was relevant to all this, but one night, selling papers, a man came off a train, I knew him by sight. He had some grapes left over in his journey from London to Leicester, and he gave me these few grapes in a bag. And roughened my hair. I had a big shock of black wavy hair, and very very friendly, and bought the paper. And after he'd gone, an outporter, a tall, grey, thin man who was dying on his feet with an outporter band to help carry luggage. He came up to me and said, "Now, if you're not careful, my lad, that chap Oscar Wilde you." Well, I didn't know what that meant. I had no idea. I didn't take any notice of it. And I never thought about it. I remember this period when I began to read. I looked in the bookshop window in the main street and I saw the works of Oscar Wilde. And there was one, Shelley, I think it was, De Profundis. For some reason or other, and why I chose that, I went in and said, I'd like that book. I said, but I've only got sixpence. It happened that a young assistant, the son of the proprietor, knew me and said, well, take it then. And I got it for sixpence. I went into the town hall square, which was all quiet, and started reading this book. I discovered then what had happened to poor Oscar Wilde, and I became an absolute Oscar Wilde fan, absolute fan. Oh, it's a wonderful book, and I read everything I could lay hold on concerning Oscar Wilde. When I went to Chorley, I met to make very friendly with a cotton mill owner who was a socialist named Charlie Sixsmith. He's also a friend of Walt Whitman. He had sort of a salon. And I told him my passion for Oscar Wilde. He said, I told him I'd read David Pond. He said, ah, but he hasn't read it all. That I know Robert Ross is as literary executive as I have the whole part of it, and some of the remaining half is in the British Museum, not be published until everybody has died, mentioned in it. So he let me read the other half that made me stronger Oscar Wilde ever since.
Mm.
Oh, now then, I hope this is
very interesting. Then, yeah.
Interesting. Mm. Some years ago, I read pretty well all Hardy's books. Some years ago, I reread The Return of the Native. Is Eustacia Vine, that one?
Yes.
Now, Hardy paints a wonderful portrait of her at the beginning. Oh, wonderful portrait. You can get a picture of him immediately. So I thought, well, I'll sculpture Eustacia Vine. She appealed to me. But I also wanted to do one of Oscar Wilde. And I made a lot of inquiries about what Oscar Wilde really looked like. I got all sorts of pictures. I went to the National Portrait Gallery. They showed me some sketches got locked away. I wrote to his son, Vivian Holland. I said, have you a profile portrait of Oscar Wilde of your father? He said, unfortunately, no. He said, for some reason or other, then my father didn't like a profile portrait. Then I wrote to St. John Irvine, who had just written a book about Oscar Wilde. So I asked him if he had a portrait of Oscar Wilde, a profile portrait. I'd got full-face portraits from the Holden Picture Library. And St. John Irvine wrote back, a profile portrait, a beastly man, said, oh, I wouldn't have a portrait of him in my book or anywhere, a beastly thing, not in those terms.
Mm.
So that was that. And I did two portraits of Oscar Wilde, as far as I can make them from what I knew, from pictures I'd seen. I also painted a full portrait, almost the size of that door, full-length portrait.
Did you really?
Of Oscar Wilde with his coat and buttonhole and collar and yellow gloves and silver knobbed ebony walking stick, walking down some steps. But none was satisfactory, and I destroyed them. Then I thought I'd do Eustacia Vine. That was purely got the imagination, plus what Hardy had written. And then I was at Wimbledon. I had a little studio. And I determined to give the whole day to this. So about 1 o'clock, my wife, Claire, she brought me some food so not to go in and just get out of touch, keep the rhythm and the atmosphere. So she looked and said, who's that? I said, Eustacia Vine. She said, never is, it's Oscar Wilde. And I looked and it was Oscar Wilde. All the coming out subconsciously. I remember when I was doing it, I lost control of myself.
Yeah.
I felt a different person.
Yeah.
And that was the result, Oscar Wilde. Well, as a result of that, about 3 weeks ago, I sent an account of it to the New Statesman. I haven't heard a word since, whether they used it or not, I don't know, but it's called An Unusual Story About Oscar Wilde. And giving all that I've told you, plus a little more. And say, they've had it 3 weeks, well, usually they'll send it back straight away if they don't want them.
Well, could you tell me a bit more about Leeds? Because it was at Leeds where you first really joined the women's movement, wasn't it? How was the branch organised? There was a branch organised by women, really, was it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, the women were there, as far as I remember. Women ran the branch. Yes, they ran it. They were in complete control from that point of view. But, to say, I always regretted and the absence of male supporters inside and outside. The numbers were infinitesimal, comparatively speaking. And I would have expected, just from the point of view of chivalry, apart from any political philosophy, to have come to the aid of women in one way or another. I can never understand any objections that they put forward. I never heard of one valid objection, not from my point of view, not one.
But were you the only journalist in Leeds who supported
women? As far as I know, yeah. Oh, no. Ah, now then. As Leonora Cohen talked to you about another journalist?
I don't think so, no.
Now then.
No.
There was another journalist on the Yorkshire Post, and he and his wife were members. Well, I'll put it this way. His wife was a member and he was a supporter. I don't know actually whether he was a member. He encouraged his wife, so to speak. And she came from Leicester. I didn't know her until I met her in Leeds. She was middle class. But and she was very active. Well, she was active on the actual militants, as distinct from the muted militants. I think it's the muted militants she favoured. But this can't be recorded. Mrs. Cohen, to my surprise, told me when I went to see her last year that they were among the informers to the local police.
Were they really?
So she said, I was surprised at that.
But
I met this fellow when I went to Leeds in during the war, last war, and he seemed as interested in the women's movement as ever, and I didn't know then what Leonora told me a year ago, but it seems to me it's still incredible that those two, his wife was very, very keen, and very sincerely enthusiastic.
But when you went to, you followed Kitty back to the police station, did you follow her because you suspected her or because you were rather fond of her?
Well, the mix of the two. you're quite right about that. The mix of the two. I was attracted to her, and I think she was attracted to me or appeared to me. But I was curious. I didn't know anything about her. And, I wouldn't rule that out. Oh, no. But there was somebody, you see, that was suspect. And nobody seemed to know much about this girl. I didn't establish any credentials or anything. And it could have been certainly the factor of attraction can't be left out. But it was also a mutual suspicion. Or a suspicion.
Yeah.
A slight suspicion. That things are not well. So there's been this constant talk about being spies in our midst, and we just didn't know.
What was Mrs. Cohen like then? Can you describe what she was like?
Very vivacious, very challenging, plenty of energy, keen vegetarian, well known. She was another addition, Mrs. Pankhurst, in a way. Probably much more vigorous physically, I wouldn't say mentally, but she was certainly very alert. And she was our guide, so to speak, and prompter, and the engineer, director in chief. Oh, yes, she was a very powerful influence. Of course, I think she was a widow then. I think she was widowed quite early, I'm not sure.
No, not then, no. She was widowed, I think, about 1929. Oh. Quite a bit later, actually. Yes.
I don't know much about her. She did tell me when we were last there about her family, about her father. Her father was a sculptor.
He was yes, that's right, yes. Yes.
And I've looked up books of reference. I traced him, and of course... name, of course his name was different, wouldn't it?
He was an Italian, it was an Italian name.
Italian name?
Mm. Yes.
And she's not a Jewess, is she?
No, but her husband was.
Her husband was, yes. Yes.
Yes. Mm. So she was a very important person then, in the branch, really. Mrs.
Oh, Mrs. Cohen was.
Yes. Mm.
I don't remember him, I don't know whether he was a member.
No, he wasn't very keen.
Oh.
No, no. So, did you keep your life as a journalist quite separate from your life as a woman suffrage supporter?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was like if I'd been a doctor or a shoemaker, it was one of my, I can't call it hobbies, but extra interests outside my work.
But did you use your extra knowledge on the paper a bit or not?
Well, whenever I could, of course. In the case of the Leeds paper, I can give any amount of published in. Of course, with a good local press in Leeds at the time, there was a Yorkshire Post, Yorkshire Observer, a Leeds Mercury, the Yorkshire Evening Post, the Yorkshire Evening News. They've got five papers there, just local, apart from agency for all the national papers. I was the national agent for the Daily Citizen. And so in one way or another, Leeds was a good centre journalistically and for the cause itself. Mm. And you could get good newspaper coverage and anything happening in Leeds. Because the most London papers, you see, are most anxious to cultivate the North. So the North had this monopoly of the Yorkshire Post, Yorkshire Observer, and so on and so forth, paper at York and paper at Halifax and so on. And the London papers were equally anxious to capture the North. That's why, of course, they established their Manchester offices.
So did you report women's activities in the newspaper locally yourself?
Oh, yes,
a lot?
Yeah. Oh, I report, yes. Oh, yeah. Mm. As far as it was news, I mean, it depends, you see. We were a weekly newspaper. Well, news happened on Monday, wouldn't be much use on Friday. I would probably report what happened on Thursday. Or in a general way, cover the whole week in an omnibus article. But certainly, I gave as much as I possibly could, and the editor was on my side, and so that was very good.
So did you advise the women on how to get into the newspapers? I mean, did you...
Oh, yes, I gave. See, later on, you probably know, I was public relations officer at the, at the post office. I knew the basic requirements in news values and so on. Oh yes, I gave them what help I could. Whatever movement I belonged to, I gave the benefit of my experience in the newspaper world.
And you think that they did quite a lot of this militancy to get in the news, really, do you? To attract headlines, really?
Oh yes, yes. Mm. Now, when I went to Chorley, I hadn't been there long before the suffragettes, I think it was Bolton this time, I'm not sure, burnt down Sir William Lever's bungalow at Rivington. You know about that?
That's Edith Pitt was involved in that, wasn't she? The suffragette in Preston.
Oh, was it Preston? I thought it was Bolton. Anyhow, it could be.
Yes.
Rivington's halfway between Bolton and Preston.
Yes.
Mm. Mm. Well, I was at Chorley at the time, and because I interested in her because I'd met Sir William Lever, and that was it. I'd forgotten about that. Was the only real suffragette experience I can recall. Preston, I believe, was fairly active.
Oh, it was, yes. Mm. Yes.
What is it? More cosmopolitan town. Chorley was absolutely hemmed in, unchanged from the mid 19th century, so to speak.
Mm.
Cotton town, say. Shawls and clogs and the knockers up, and a division, Catholics, Protestants, this sharp division, antagonism, and whereas in Preston it was more cosmopolitan and more professional people. Trotters, nearly all working class people.
Yes, yes. So when you were in Leeds, the newspaper, the letter burning was designed to get in the local papers, really, was it? When you put incendiaries in the news, in the letters, in the pillar boxes, that was to get in the newspapers.
Oh, that's in the newspapers, yes, yes.
Mm.
And another thing we did, by the way, again, publicly, was writing letters to the editor. That was a very good avenue, really, writing letters. And sometimes, on a weekly newspaper, more than once, I have written letters under other names. You probably know them. There's still a common practice in some local newspapers. They know correspondence is very interesting, and members of the staff write letters under quid pro quo or under some false name, Jack Smith or something like that. Mm. So we found letters to the editor a very good avenue.
So you'd sometimes write letters as a journalist on the paper to the paper about woman suffrage.
Oh yes. And of course with the connivance of the editor.
Yes.
The editor knew, of course. Oh yeah. That happened at Wimslow several times. Letters to the editor were letters to the editor should be a feature of any newspaper, and they realised that, and if letters weren't coming in, well, we had to start the ball rolling. And sometimes we started with a letter, it would bring in other letters. That's the idea, you see. I think the way it's fair game to start a thing rolling, but to continue all the time with the homemade letters wrong. And purely, it was really immoral, and misleading.
So you were very helpful to the Leeds suffragettes by advising them
on...
You mentioned Frank Rutter.
Rutter.
Why was he connected with the women then? What made him a woman suffrage supporter, do you think?
I'm sorry?
Why did Frank Rutter support woman suffrage in Leeds? What made Frank Rutter
Frank Rutter. I don't know. He was a very learned man, fine chap. He was a Cambridge man. He worked on the Daily Mail as a sub-editor for a period, but his father was a barrister, I think, and his mother was a painter. Anyhow, he wrote a lot of books on art, and when it published a number, he was appointed curator of the Leeds Art Gallery. I think his wife, who really interested in women's suffrage, I think she came from Australia. Didn't Lord Cohen tell you?
No, she didn't tell me much about that, no.
I don't know if she came from Australia, but I got an impression, because I remember once when we went up there for an evening meal, the walls were covered with cartoons from the first Daily Herald that was published before the war, and those cartoons, the Daily Herald before the war, First World War, was noted for some amazing cartoons by an Australian cartoonist. I forget his name, it wasn't Lowe. Anyhow, the marvellous cartoons, the whole wall was covered with them, and I think I learnt then that the reason they had them was, apart from the fact they were good propaganda, Labour propaganda and some vote for women propaganda, the fact it was an Australian, and she, I think, sort of was nostalgic.
Yes, yes.
I'm sure she was an Australian. I think she was the prime mover in the Rutter business. I often met Frank Rutter, but we also used to talk about art instead of women's suffrage. I remember one thing he said, the way to succeed in art is to paint is a proper line of least resistance, and I'm very good. Do the thing you can do easily, not try to do the impossible.
Was your first wife a woman suffrage?
Well,
supporter?
Not keen. She was interested, but she wasn't. She wasn't keen. She used to come with me to all these functions, and she liked to see her husband on the platform or doing this, that, and the other. Oh yes, she's very well read.
But you didn't meet her in the movement then?
No. Yeah. I met her at Oddley Edge, and we married at Women's Move. I always say she knew French better than 99% of the French people. She absolutely knew every aspect of French grammar. Was astonishing. she could read any part of the Bible. You can start and in many cases you continue. That an extraordinary memory. And she told me once that she lived in the Cheshire village, 4 miles from the next house, and my candlelight, I had a candlelight. She used to read a chapter of the Bible every day for 10 years, my candlelight. Not that she was particularly religious, but it was something to do. And she got this fantastic memory and could carry on. In the Times, every day, so used to have a piece at the top of the personal column, quotation of the Bible. She would often carry on, knew the prayer book by heart, and put many a parson to shame and come talking to them.
What did you do in the Leeds branch of the WSPU? How did it spend its time? What did it do?
Of course, I couldn't spend all my time, except there were sort of a full-time officials and part-time people working all day at the headquarters. I forget where they were now, the headquarters. Somewhere near the post office, near the centre of the town, of course. And they'd know all the correspondence, all sorts of things, planning, arranging. I see people like myself could only go to the evening meetings except on a Saturday or a Sunday. So Leonora Kern would know all about that. She'd know all the mechanics.
Yes, yes.
She was the petrol engine, so to speak. She was the driving force, and she knew everything and everybody, and they knew her, like at Rosyth-on-Sea. I went there, I said, where is Leonora Cohen to be found? Oh, up there. Everybody knew her.
Did you ever burn any letters yourself?
Pardon?
Did you ever set fire to any letters yourself?
I just trying to recall. I think I must have done, I just can't recall. But I know when I was appointed to the post office, I smiled that I used to destroy the mail.
That's very, very interesting. Very interesting. Well.